is Barrett Brown. Thanks for listening to our Who, What, Why podcast. Barry Eisler is a former CIA director of operations official and a best-selling thriller novelist. He's also a longtime critic of CIA practices and a here and there sort of pundit who's weighed in on a number of issues facing the Republic over the last 15 years. Barry, let me ask you this. Are we facing a different polity, fundamentally, a different civic situation than we were 10 years ago?
I think of it, the short answer, I guess, would be yes, but not necessarily so much because our civics have changed as much as our circumstances have. So changing circumstances would require changing civics, and if the circumstances change and the civics don't, then that's going to create a problem for the Republic. And the circumstances that have changed, as I see it, is the increasing metastasis of surveillance technology, such that the government is able to know more and more about the citizenry, even as we, the citizenry, know less and less about the government. And that's going to require a different kind of civics. But I don't think a different kind of civics has adequately emerged to meet those changing circumstances.
Is our republic viable?
I can't say I feel terribly optimistic at the moment, in part just because I try to place most of my confidence in patterns I see rather than particular historical moments. And the pattern is, how long do empires last? America, the American experiment, has now been around for close to 250 years. That's a reasonably long run. And I see a pattern in which the kinds of fights our ruling elite are willing to engage in have changed from fights you could at least reasonably argue were more important from any sort of reasonable national security perspective to ones that are primarily petty and have more to do with ego than any kind of substantive national security concerns. And I look at that as kind of the psychology of an increasingly old and senescent empire. It's just what happens. I think there's even an expression that empires start off fighting big opponents, big enemies, and end up fighting small ones. And I think that pattern tends to fit what we see here in the American empire.
So sort of a two-part question. For one thing, do you believe that aside from its expanded surveillance capabilities, that the CIA plays less of a central role in these fights than it did, say, in the 50s and 60s? And if so, does that reflect what you're referring to regarding the lessening of what these struggles are about, the struggles among the elites?
So when you're talking about the 60s and 70s, or I guess even earlier, the 50s, are you talking about CIA-inspired coups like in Iran and Guatemala, that sort of thing?
Yeah, just in general, both in terms of its ability to exert power domestically, you know, within, we had that complicated situation with Nixon, where, of course, the CIA played some role in, you know, surveilling the White House, just as the Pentagon did. And over time, you know, obviously had some degree of influence. And then, yes, in addition to that, also its power projection, its ability to overthrow governments abroad and that sort of thing, influence policies, you know, splash back its information, has its role or has its ability to serve as the policymaking tool of a handful of people. Has that diminished since the 60s and 70s?
It's a good question. I mean, the short answer, I guess, would be, well, it would be hard to know, right? You wouldn't know necessarily what's going on inside the CIA. You'd have to try to work backwards from results in the external world and then try to deduce from that what sort of power the CIA might be able to wield. And one way of looking at one sign, at least arguably, of diminishing CIA ability to influence the outcome of elections is, of course, the 2016 election in America, where the CIA establishment seemed intent on stopping Trump. Now, I wouldn't call this a slam dunk argument. There are different ways of looking at this. I think most of what self-conceives as the American national security establishment has been against Trump because he seems psychologically unfit. He's erratic. He's a threat to the kind of stability at home and abroad from which American elites, the American establishment, profits and derives its power. So on that, from that standpoint, the CIA establishment would be expected to be against Trump, and indeed various former high-level CIA people like Mike Morrell were actually writing New York Times and Washington Post op-eds criticizing Trump, saying he's unfit, and praising Hillary Clinton as being an experienced, trustworthy foreign policy hand. On the other hand, Trump seems fairly easy to manipulate when it comes to military intelligence and security budgets, that sort of thing. So from that standpoint, you might think that the intelligence establishment, the deep state, would welcome a Trump. But overall, the evidence, it seems to me, has been that the American deep state has not been in favor of Trump. And yet, despite whatever efforts they were able to try to pull off, Trump was still elected president. So I would look at that as an example of, look, with back in the heyday in the 1950s in Iran and Guatemala, the CIA was able to successfully install minority governments that that America favored in those countries. It seems that in 2016, it had lost some of that mojo.
From the outside, from the public space, it looks like the caliber of, say, presidents and other high figures in this country and throughout the West are of a smaller stature, setting aside morality, but a smaller stature in terms of their ability to achieve, you know, tremendous change compared to the 20th century. Like, we have smaller presidents now than Lyndon Johnson and Nixon and... Right. That sort of thing. Do you think the same is true within the intelligence establishment and the rest of the peripheral bureaucracy around them?
So that the
is George Tenet is no Alan Dulles? Is that correct in terms of capabilities?
It seems fair to say, doesn't it? The reason I hesitate is because there seems to be a tendency to look back and recognize that presidents were more capable than people thought at the time. So I know, for example, when FDR died and Harry Truman became president, people thought he was a lightweight. And now there's been this revisionist approach where people look back at Truman as a really capable, a good president. Eisenhower also at the time was looked at as someone who didn't have a lot of brains, which is kind of weird when you consider his accomplishments growing up from nothing. He was a nobody, grew up poor, and wound up commanding overlord in World War II. President, I think Eisenhower actually played it a bit dumb in front of the press when there was something he didn't want to acknowledge. He would garble the syntax and everybody thought he was stupid. But still, at the time, he was considered a bit of a lightweight compared to someone like Adlai Stevenson. And now in retrospect, people realize this guy knew exactly what was going on, whether you agreed with various of his policies or not. Reagan would be another example. There's been a whole, I remember how I looked at Reagan at the time. He seemed a bit dim. Now people look back and think he was this great manager who ended the Cold War. There's even a revisionist approach right now with George W. Bush, which I personally find really surprising. But almost the best proof I know of, certainly the most recent, of the tendency to look back at almost any former president with a degree of nostalgia. So it's hard for me to imagine people looking back at the Trump presidency and saying, you know what, he was more capable than we thought. I think this is pretty, it's hard for me to imagine that this is not some sort of nadir of incompetence and unfitness, psychological unfitness, but maybe people will find a way to rehabilitate him too. So I don't really know. My sense is that, yes, there has been a decline in the quality of leadership at the national level, and if that's the case, why wouldn't it be true in some of the lower ranking roles in the national security apparatus, the deep state as well? It would seem to follow. If the head is dying, why would the body be thriving? That wouldn't necessarily make sense to me.
Do you think there's a problem with the body itself? As in, do you think that, again, it seems like we're not entirely in agreement on whether or not there has been a clear degeneration of the presidency. I would say, you know, it would be hard to point to somebody like Woodrow Wilson or Theodore Roosevelt in terms of mental power, not in terms of, you know, whether we agree with their policies. But let's say, to the extent that we acknowledge it, to the extent that we say there has been some deterioration, maybe not as much, maybe we don't know enough to decide that yet. Has there been a similar deterioration among the body politic since, let's say, the 30s and 40s?
I think the answer is yes, and to the extent I would hesitate at all, it's just, again, in recognition of a pattern, and the pattern is every generation thinks that the new generation, the one coming after it, is doom. So I'll bet if you go back 200 years in American history, you'll have people like John Quincy Adams was probably saying, "Oh, this next generation is doomed. They're lazy, they're thoughtless. They have no idea how hard we had it or how hard we had to fight for everything that they take for granted, and the republic is now doomed." It just seems like it's always like that. The parents always think the children's generation is lazy or has it too easy and is it's just going to spell doom for civilization. So there's that pattern, and that pattern to some degree gives me some hope, because it makes me think maybe I'm wrong in what I'm about to say, which is, yeah, it does seem like there's just a kind of bread and circus mentality in America, a distractibility that reminds me almost of the way prison guards set prisoners against each other so that they can divide and rule. It's almost just a reflex on the part of any kind of ruling establishment to do that with the numerically superior prisoners or polity or whatever. So when I look at the kinds of arguments that citizens are often having, I find it astonishing. I think a Martian certainly would be astonished. Is this a democracy? And just off the top of my head, a couple of quick examples. It's amazing to me. 3 years ago, or 4 years ago now, when Edward Snowden first came forward and shared his trove of secret documents with Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras, I was amazed at how many journalists were pushing the propaganda line that Snowden violated his oath of secrecy. First of all, there is no oath of secrecy. That's pure propaganda. There is only an NDA that CIA employees, NSA employees, and other people who have top secret clearance in the American government, they do in fact sign a non-disclosure agreement, an NDA. But there is an actual oath that is sworn, and that is the oath to protect and defend the Constitution. So the fact that journalists would, I don't even think it was deliberate. I think it was out of ignorance. People like Josh Marshall and TPM, I remember, were talking about this oath of secrecy. And I was thinking, what are you talking about? But I don't think Marshall understood that he was just parroting a line of government propaganda. He just wanted to believe that that Snowden had done a terrible thing, because Josh Marshall himself believes that secrecy is in some way sacrosanct. So because he has that framework, he believed it when someone told him, hey, there's an oath of secrecy. It made perfect sense to him that secrecy is something someone might swear an oath to. So when I look at journalists adopting that kind of line, I find it really concerning. But then similarly, when the citizenry, at least at the outset, seemed equally divided on the somewhat simplistic question, I guess, of whether Snowden was a hero or a traitor. And I thought, the government is abusing its secrecy powers. No one actually disputes this. Literally no one would argue that the government properly doesn't overclassify. So in the face of all this, this situation, this dynamic I mentioned earlier, where the government knows more and more about us and we know less and less about the government, in the face of all that, to be on the side, to be a citizen, to be the one who knows less and less and is more and more exposed, and yet when finally somebody shines a little bit of light on government activities that actually turned out to be criminal or unconstitutional, and still to say, oh, it would have been better if we didn't know that, that makes me feel like there might be something rotten in the citizenry itself, to be so, I don't know, in the grip of some sort of Stockholm syndrome, that you would actually take the side of your oppressors when someone tries to give you information that can better enable you to govern yourselves as you're supposed to be able to do. Yeah, that really does make me very concerned about the state of American politics.
Barry Osler, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Barrett.
In December of 2001, New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman took a trip to Moscow in order that the American citizenry might be better informed regarding the nation with which it had previously been locked into a half-century struggle that had ended millions of lives and threatened a billion more. The resulting column began with two observations. It seems that, quote, sushi bars are opening all over. Yes, from borscht to Big Macs to California criminal rolls, all in one decade. And so many people have cars now that traffic is permanently starved. Unquote. One could have perhaps described such growth to the 1998 devaluation of the ruble, several years of significant increases in the price of oil and other Russian exports, or to the economic reforms that have been spearheaded largely by former Prime Minister Primakov a few years prior to Friedman's writing. But such things as those lack a certain thematic oomph. The Russians, Friedman explained, had finally gotten themselves a leader worth having in the transformative person of Vladimir Putin. Quote, he's not a tougher Mikhail Gorbachev or a more sober Boris Yeltsin. He is Russia's first Deng Xiaoping, Mao's pragmatic successor who first told the Chinese that to get rich is glorious and put in place the modernizing reforms to do it. Unquote. He went on to summarize Putin's thought process vis-a-vis Russia as, quote, passing real reform legislation so we can get real investment to build a real modern economy, unquote. Friedman therefore ends his column with the following call to action. Quote, so keep rooting for Putin and hope that he makes it to the front of Russia's last line, unquote. The last line established earlier in the column is the line for money for some reason. Friedman wrote his sushi-oriented pro-Putin column in December of 2001. In March of that same year, Friedman had written another column on Russia in which he summarized our post-Cold War espionage efforts by way of the following framework. Quote, what is it that we and Russians are actually spying on each other about? This whole espionage affair seems straight out of Mad Magazine's spy versus spy cartoon. The Russians are spying on us to try to find out why we are spying on them. I mean, to be honest, is there anything about the Russians today you want to know? Their navy is resting in port. Their latest nuclear submarine is resting on the bottom of the ocean. We know they're selling weapons to Iran and Iraq because they told us. And their current political system, unlike communism, is not exactly exportable. Unless you think corruption, chaos, and KGB rule amount to an ideology, Khrushchev threatened to bury us. Putin threatens to corrupt us, unquote. Having made such an unusual assertion, Friedman next quote notes the following conundrum. Quote, how you pull a country like Russia away from being an angry, failed state, acting out on the world stage, and making a responsible member of the world community has no easy formula, unquote. We have here two assertions then. Allow me to organize them into a list. Number one, we have no good reason to be covertly gathering intelligence on Russia. Number two, unless it is somehow, quote, pulled away, quote, from doing so, Russia is set to become a, quote, angry, failed state acting out on the world stage, unquote. Remember that these two assertions are both made in the space of a single column. In 2008, the large adversarial and nuclear-equipped nation upon which we apparently did not bother to spy launched a military incursion into Georgia. Friedman responded with a column entitled, What Did We Expect? That begins thusly. Quote, if the conflict in Georgia were an Olympic event, the gold medal for British stupidity would go to the Russian Prime Minister, Vladimir Putin. The silver medal for boneheaded recklessness would go to Georgia's president, Mikhail Saakashvili. And the bronze medal for rank short-sightedness would go to the Clinton and Bush foreign policy teams, unquote. The bronze medal winners in this case had advocated NATO expansion after the end of the Cold War, whereas Friedman and other leading foreign policy experts, Friedman explains, had opposed such a move on the grounds that it might antagonize the Russians without providing the West with any particularly crucial benefits. As he concludes, quote, the humiliation that NATO expansion bred in Russia was critical in fueling Putin's rise after Boris Yeltsin moved on, unquote. So back in March of 2001, Friedman mocked the U.S. intelligence community for wanting accurate information about Russia. Later that year, he explained to us what was going on in Russia, and he just elected a great reformer president, with whom we should strongly support. Years later, when Putin turned out to be a tyrant and invaded Georgia, he criticized the U.S. intelligence community for being unprepared. Thomas Friedman is a Pulitzer Prize winner. He now sits on the Pulitzer Prize board. Thanks for listening to our Who, What, Why podcast.